Okay, we'll do a click. One, two, three. Well, was it? Yeah, we got it.
Going for a drive, do a little gig, then drive back, back with the chat. It's called the debrief. It's called the debrief. It's called the debrief.
Welcome to the podcast, A Debrief, where I chat to comedians, generally after or before gigs, but because there's no gigs really, I've just been ringing them to see how they're going, and I've got a comedy legend who's sitting in his own studio. It's Ross Noble, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, I think studio is, when all the COVID business started, I've got like a sound desk thing, and, I had it all sort of propped up, and then as time's gone on, as there's been like nothing to do, I've sort of then, I've built like a little integral, I've built like a wooden thing that it fits into, and then I've got like I drilled a hole, and then I've got like one of those boom mics, so that's got all professional. And then I'd set up some cardboard boxes for when I was doing like kind of video stuff, and then now I've got a full like a massive green screen, so
wow.
yeah so now I've gone from being like going, God, I've got to plug this in, to just go, no, if we're doing this, we're doing this properly. So, it's getting there, you know. So I want to try and build, like, have you seen the stuff that John Favreau is using when he's shooting The Mandalorian, where he's got this,
yes,
the volume, where I think that's what, is it called, the volume, where it's just 360-degree video screens and a ceiling. And I'm looking around just going, I wonder if I could build one of them myself.
Oh, I watched the Mandalorian because my kids love it, and then I watched the behind the scenes. It was fantastic.
It's incredible, isn't it? Just, you know, the fact that you can and even like, so they've got this that screen thing, but then also like what they do with the Jungle Book, where they had, you know, a fully green room, but then built the set, but then you can move the camera around, like inside and that's probably, I don't know, you look at early special effects, that's probably what, 25 years, we'll all have that. And then, you know, that's a game changer, you know. Even you know how like now you'll have like sort of fairly shit TV shows, they'll have a bit of special effects which would have cost millions a few years ago. We're going to have soap operas on the telly where, you know, like even stuff like Home and Away, there'll be like a shark attack, and there'll be like proper sharks.
Yeah, look really good.
Coming out the water and that, and then, you know, that's the future.
It's like when Toadie killed his young bride Dee, he just ran off the road in his station wagon. It's just not spectacular at all.
Did he kill her?
Yeah, but then she came back, Madeline West, she came back.
So. Yeah.
No one really dies in Neighbours or Home and Away, they just come back.
Yeah, well, Harold... He went missing for years,
2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and then he. But I always thought that was that like a Harold Holt? Was that like a? Was
oh
that
wow!
Like, was that like a little in joke there? Was that the idea that Harold went missing?
And then that's a long game if they're doing that as a joke, because that Harold was in it for years, and then he did fall off rocks though. He fell in the ocean.
Yeah,
Harold.
That's what I mean. Yeah. My two favorite Neighbours things ever, like one was, do you remember, well, there's three actually. There was one where Guy Pearce punched three small inflatable Santas out of anger. That was a great episode. There was three small inflatable Santas, and he got really angry. Punch, 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 like that. Lovely.
I don't remember that one. Even though I did watch the Guy Pearce, because I used to live in a shared house in the 80s, and we used to watch Neighbours, because of course there was no Netflix. And we all used to sit around, because we were relatively poor. We used to watch so much of that TV. We watched Neighbours. We didn't watch Home and Away, but we loved Neighbours. And I remember when Daphne the stripper, I remember when Bouncer the dog got killed.
He got that was
run over by, I think it was Greg Fleet driving the minivan. He killed Bouncer the dog.
Well, that was going to be, there was an episode, and I honestly thought this, I thought this was a dream, right? And then it's true, yeah. And it turns out it wasn't just me misremembering. So in the UK, so like I used to, so Neighbours was so popular in Britain that it used to be on twice a day.
I heard that.
So yes, it was like
same episode, just repeated.
Yeah, same episode, but they would have it on at so the new episode would come out. It would be on just after lunch, and then it was on again at 5:30 in the evening. So you got like so all the students and the nanas and all that, and all the, you know, the stay at home parents used to watch it in the afternoon. Yeah. And then but then they used to put it on in the evening, because what was happening was so many people were basically skiving off university and skiving off school to watch Neighbours that they had to put it on later. Yeah, and it was mad. It was the same. Yeah, it was. Or maybe it was the night. It was the episode from the night before. No, because then why would people stay off? Anyway, yeah. So it was on twice a day. So we used to. When I was a kid, I'm sort of ashamed to admit this, but when I was a kid, the only thing that that really the only two things that we knew about Australia was basically Neighbours and Crocodile Dundee.
But that's normal.
I know, but even so, how shameful is that? The fact that that was the only two. You either went, either everybody lives in a brick, just in a brick box, or they live in the outback. That was the, you know, it's just insanity of it. But so we used to watch it all the time, and there was an episode where it was Bouncer's dream. Do you remember that?
The dog. This is what was Bouncer the dog.
Yeah, Bouncer the dream. Dog. Yeah. So what happened was Bouncer the dog. He'd fallen into an inspection hatch and was down there, and the whole episode was basically from Bouncer's point of view.
That's just the writers getting bored, I reckon, going, what can we do? What can we...
And they just went, let's do a whole episode. And then I was lucky enough to work with Ian Smith, who played Harold. And apparently, like, back in those days, they used to, because again, it's not a thing over here, but like pantomimes are like massive.
Yeah, huge, aren't they?
Massive.
Yeah.
And all the Neighbours cast used to come over, and they would do, you know, like sort of 10 weeks in panto in the big theatres in the UK, and they were paid so much money. You know, if you
they talk about that, actually, those guys, Dr. Carl and those guys.
Yeah, like so much money, and they would come over, and because it's not a tradition, it's like you know, they'd come over and be kind of like, what is this, what do we have to do? And you go, well,
yeah,
you,
he's behind it, you and all that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So but I forget,
do they still do them, those panos?
Yeah, oh god, yeah very well, probably not this year, but
no,
yeah, they're oh god, yeah, no, they're still huge. They sort of, that's what keeps a lot of the theatres in business. You know, they make so much money from the, you know, from the pantos and that you know, that sort of subsidizes the arts, because the government don't put any money.
Could
into
it ever?
It.
Could so? I had a friend who talks about doing it here. Could, do you reckon they ever go well here, pantos, or is it a very British thing?
I think you could do it here, but it would be, It would be the sort of thing where it's such a British tradition that I think you'd have to get the expats to, you know, I think the expats would turn up, but there's something also about panto where, like, back in, because you know, it goes back, you know, years and years, so like it was the sort of thing where the big variety stars of yesteryear, there was some people, there was a lot of acts who they specialised in, you know, being the dame, the man dressed as the woman, was like a big thing where, you know, it was considered a real art form, you know. And then you know, and the idea of, you know, being a pantomime dame was like a real, you know, because there's all the different, you know, there was like principal boy, which was a woman dressed as a boy, And then there was like the Buttons character, and like Buttons, she'll have like, it's Buttons in Cinderella, it's Idle Jack in Jack and the Beanstalk. What is it in Wishy Washy in Aladdin? And they're sort of like, they're the kind of the brother of the, so like Wishy Washy is like, you know, usually the brother of the leading man sort of thing.
Ah, right.
So it's basically the same. So the dame is a man dressed as a woman who plays the mother of the sort of comic relief, which is always, so that's always played by a comic. And then the dame is always played by an older comedian who can no longer play Buttons, but becomes a dame. That's always a man dressed as a woman. And and then the lead, you know, the lead character, you sort of like Peter Pan, in the past,
they're a good-looking person, wasn't it? Normally,
but yeah, but it is now. But it used to be a woman dressed as a boy. That was,
oh, of course,
that was always the, you know. So there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of people of a certain generation who basically, you know, were kind of quite confused by the whole, Peter Pan's something, you know, something going on, yeah. But because of that, then what happened was, you know, through the sort of the 50s and the 60s, you know, sort of into the 70s, you would have huge TV stars, like proper big names, TV stars, appearing in pantomime. And then it started to become a bit of a joke, you know, like where... You know, you would have the huge ones, the big Birmingham Hippodrome, you know, the London Palladium, the, you know, the big Bristol Hippodrome, all of these huge variety theatres. But then all of the, because it was all the theatres, depending on how big a star you are, and that's kind of continued today, there's like a sliding scale of like, so the Palladium has one, and that's all the big stars. You'll have your Dawn French, Paul O'Grady, all of those, Nigel Havers, people like that. They're all in that one. And then
when you go to the regional one, surely it gets a lot thin on the ground.
Exactly. Is that right? So, so you've got all the huge ones like Birmingham Hippodrome, they'll still have big stars in it. But yeah, once you start getting to the you know, the Harlequin Theatre, Epsom, or whatever it's called,
yeah,
and you'll have this. It's quite funny because you'll get like, we went to see one in Tunbridge Wells a few years ago, and it was Sue Pollard who played.
Birds of the Feather? No.
You're thinking of, Pauline Quirk, Linda Robson.
Pauline Quirk, she's famous though. So who's Sue Pollard?
Sue Pollard played the, do you remember the TV show Heidi High?
Dad loved Heidi High. Yeah.
So she was the Peggy, the chalet maid.
Oh, okay.
You know, the one with the glasses that desperately wanted to be a red coat.
Yes, yeah.
You know, a massive star, like a massive star in the 80s, but, you know, hasn't been in any, hasn't really done any, like, major TV since then.
No.
And then, so, you know, it's just this, or another
who
one.
Was the comic? Was there a comic in a role, or?
No. Sometimes when you get to those lower, when you get to those sort of regional ones, there's only the budget for...
Yeah, for like, one person.
For one name. You'll get some really good comics, but they're just not known, you know. So
and you've never done a panto, but you've done a musical, haven't you? Have you done a panto? I know you've done a musical.
I've done two musicals now, but I've never done a panto. And it's a tricky one because it's the sort of thing where there's this sort of snobbery that it's kind of like, you know, there's a snobbery around that. So I'm I think I will, but to be honest, it was that thing of I thought I'll just leave it till sort of later in my career.
Well, it's like cruise ships, isn't it? There's a snobbery around. I've never done a cruise ship, but, you know, plenty of our colleagues have done cruise ships. Certainly not at the moment, but you think, you know what I said about cruise ships? They'll always be there. You know what I mean? So when I'm 70, perfect. Get on the cruise ship. You know?
But have you revised that now?
Yes. I don't want to die on the cruise ship.
That's the insane thing. I don't know how this is kind of what this podcast is supposed to be about, but I've always had that thing of going, I'll always work live. I'll always be able to, and I've, you know, that thing of going, you know, even if the numbers dwindle to sort
of. Yeah, you'll still get an audience.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I always looked at it and just went, you know what? Even if I played to a couple of hundred a night, that's enough. There's enough money there to more than, you know, it might mean that I have to work for the whole year, but that'll always be there, and I'll never be, you know. Even if something horrendous, you know, some happens. Awful, horrendous thing happened, that's always going to be there. And on top of that, so I've never had that feeling of going, you know, because I've never had a job. I started doing stand-up when I was, you know, still at school, you know. So it was kind of like, I left school and just did it, you know. So, yeah, so I've never been, and whenever people have said, oh, what you know? What have you got to fall back on? I've always laughed in their face and just gone, I don't need to fall back on anything because I'm quite good at this. And then,
this virus hit.
Yeah, and it's just like, because the other thing is as well is I always used to say to my missus whenever she just went, she would say to me, "What have you got? Like, what if you you know?" I'd go off and I'd be riding motorbikes, and you go, "What if you break your legs and you can't do stand-up? What if you're in a wheelchair?" And I go,
"Yeah,
I'll just do radio." Like, I'll just go, fair enough. If I can't perform live, or if I get some, like, some sort of embolism that, you know, oh, you can't go on planes anymore, I thought, fine, I'll get into radio. And then this hits, and all the radio stations go, "Oh, no, we haven't got any money." And I'm going, no, sorry, you know how for years you've been going, just come and do a radio show, and I've been going, oh, I'm too busy doing stand-up. I've got a bit of time now, can I do it? And all the radio stations were just like, it was hilarious. I just thought, I literally, in my arrogance, just went, I'll just ring up the radio. Got any jobs? No.
Like, it's just one bloke who answers the phone. Hello, radio. Yeah, sorry, Ross.
Yeah.
Nothing at the moment, young man. Well, all the radio people just hang on to their jobs. That's what's happening. No one wants to have a break. But the musicals you were in, I'm trying to remember I talked to you about it once before and it was fascinating. Young Frankenstein. You're in Young Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And what was the other one you were in?
I was in The Producers as well.
So I did
The Producers, and then that was
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it was So again, there's a sort of sliding scale of you know, like with musical theatre. So,
was it in Norwich or something like that?
We didn't play in Norwich, but we did play
Milton Keynes. And I've heard you discussing on your latest podcast or on your podcast. Milton
Keynes. Yeah, I've done stand up in Milton Keynes many times.
In the leisure centre, where if they would open a door, you'd see someone playing badminton. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Clock in for comedy. It was called.
We had one in Wantirna in Melbourne where it was in a gym, and you'd walk, there'd be guys lifting weights as you'd, where's the comedy? Through there, mate. And you go into just a room, you know, anyway.
There's a great one in,
so where was The Producers on? Where was that on there?
So that was, just quickly before I forget though, if you're ever in the UK and you have a chance to play the Crescent in Peterborough,
that's a leisure centre. It's
the great thing about that one is, so there's the Sand Centre in Carlisle, and that's got they set it up as a theatre. It holds about 1,500, but before the auditorium.
That's big.
It's a decent sized room, but it's like four basketball courts, and you want it to be full, because if it isn't full, when you're doing the sound check, you can see the markings of the basketball court on the floor. But there's no other in Carlisle. There's one in Glasgow, and there's one in Newcastle, and there's one in like Manchester, and there's nothing else like in that whole part of the country. That's the only place. But the Crescent in Peterborough has got the dressing room. You go out there, and so they've got it set up as an auditorium, and it kind of looks all right. It looks like a theatre, but the dressing room has got a full-size climbing wall in it.
Oh, fantastic.
But so what was this? Yeah, so the producers was basically it had opened on Broadway and it was like massive hit on Broadway, and then it had transferred to the West End, done well there, and then it had toured the UK. This was probably about 15 years ago now. So it had toured the UK, and then it had sort of run its, you know, it sort of run its course, and then they were going, oh, we'll do like a revival of it. So the idea was they were going to do a big UK tour, you know, of the show. But when they did it originally, obviously it was Susan Stroman who directed it, you know, basically directed it, choreographed it, worked really closely with Mel Brooks, created this show. And then the production that I was in was there. It was the first time it had been done like professionally, but with different direction.
So they
had different sets, and it was sort of reimagined. And so the production that I was in is still great, but it wasn't the same sets and costumes and everything that Nathan Lane had done. So we toured the UK with that, and then off the back of that, they'd done Young Frankenstein in New York. And what had happened was is that because the producers had been such a massive success there, they'd basically got all these investors for Young Frankenstein, and the thing they put it on in the biggest I can just hear my phone's ringing. I'll ignore that.
I can't hear that.
Oh, that's fine then. All right. Never happened. So they put it on in New York, and it was in the biggest theater on Broadway. They spent so much money on it. The show ended up, it had Megan Mullally was playing Elizabeth.
Oh, wow.
It got to the point where, so they expanded her part, and then the whole thing started getting bigger and bigger. And then they ended up with, basically the way Mel Brooks describes it, as it was basically turned into a theme park ride. So the whole thing was just, they had these giant sets, 3 hours long, and it was the most expensive ticket in Broadway history at the time.
Whoa.
So because of that, it had sort of got away from being, it had become a spectacle rather than, it had got away from the comedy. And it, even though it had sort of done well, but it hadn't, because the tickets were so expensive, it took a bit of heat for that. Yeah. And then they had to fill up, you know, it was some ridiculous, like 3,500 seats a night. So it hadn't had the same success as the producers. So, So basically the idea was Stroman and Mel Brooks got together and just went, let's revisit Young Frankenstein, but let's do it in the West End in London, rewrite the whole thing and just streamline it down. So it's
make it smaller, and
turn it into a sort of, and really sort of focus on the comedy. So Mel Brooks came over. So he spent a couple of years rewriting it and jigging it around. And then, he came over and, we basically was in the room like the whole time we were rehearsing. He was there, and he was changing gags and he was rewriting it. And
yeah, that's amazing. So you got to work with Mel Brooks.
It was incredible. It's the most creatively, it's the most amazing thing I've ever been involved with. Like, because not only is it like, because it was, you know, it's full. It's like, I thought, oh yeah, I'll reinvent myself as a song and dance man. And Susan Stroman, who, again, it's one of those things where, you know, I was really excited just to be working with Mel Brooks, you know, and that was but the thing is that Susan Stroman is like, she's one of the greatest directors of and choreographers like in Broadway history. So all of a sudden you've got these two people who are, you know, like Mel's like obsessive about the comedy and is just, you know, he's like a, you know, he's like really specific about, because it's, because everything's his voice as well, you know. It's like he knows how he wants it to sound, and there's a rhythm to it. It's not like, it's not like some people will write a show and then they'll just kind of hand it over and go, oh, now
yeah, he's involved,
you
yeah.
know. So yeah, so she's this sort of you know, she's this insane talent. So the two of them, the two of them are in the room, just like even though they like, because they'd done the show before, they kind of knew what they knew what worked and what didn't work,
yeah.
and how they wanted to change it and stuff. And yeah, so the first time, and Mel would literally sit there. He would sit like kind of. So we had the rehearsal room like taped out, you know, where the stage was, and he would sit, because it's not big enough, but it's not like there's enough room for there to be a gap where the orchestra would be or whatever. So
yeah.
you were performing. And he would sit right in front of us, like a meter in front of us, like yeah. meter and a half. And
no pressure.
And what was amazing about him is that, like, he, if the joke's not going, if the comedy's not landing, he sits there and he just, like, with his hand on his forehead, or he just sits there shaking his head, like, just like going. You know, and he's very, very like, you know, what the fuck was that? Just like really full on. But on the flip side of that,
yeah,
when it lands, and this is where you go, oh my God, this is like the greatest thing. When it lands, he, even though he wrote it, it's his idea, his, when it lands, he laughs. Like just loses it, like
yeah, it's his
just,
head off.
He just sort of, he just goes and he's just, oh my God, that's it, don't change it, do it exactly like that. And you're quite
a good impressionist. I've never seen you do impressions in your act. I don't think it's one thing you do, but
you know what, I sneak them in. I sneak them in under.
I love
the,
a good impression.
Oh, I do, but I like to
you just, don't want to be one of those guys who just says, all right, here, Arnold Schwarzenegger walks into a bar and meets Bart Simpson. Here we go. You
know, horrible. Like,
what?
Absolutely horrible. My favorite thing is I like to do impressions, but I like to make them. So what I'll do is I'll do an impression of somebody, but I'll create a character in. So I'll be on stage and I'll be improvising something and I'll create a character. But then what I'll do is I'll do the voice of, like, I'll do somebody, like, an impression of somebody, but just make that person be that, you know what I mean?
So you go,
oh, there's a greengrocer or whatever, and then, you know, I'll just.
They're Nicolas Cage or whatever.
Exactly. Or I'll just yeah, go, like, yeah. you know, but I won't go.
I know he's one of your favourites. That's why I mentioned
him. Oh, I love him. Yeah. I absolutely, absolutely love him. So, yeah, so it's, I'll go, oh, it's, Ozzy Osbourne is, and people go, are you doing Ozzy Osbourne? I'm like, shut up.
And I'm trying to remember where I first met you, because you've been in comedy a long time. So, I reckon at the festival. I must have met you at the comedy festival at some stage.
Did you, were you, because I remember,
I remember interviewing on the radio, that's for sure. Yeah.
Would it have, you know where it might have been? It might have been at, do you remember Dave Taranto's gig?
Of course, the cheese shop.
I think that's where we first met.
Yes, but because I was Triple R for a long time. The radio station.
But were you in Edinburgh? Because I know, like, I'd met
a
few.
No, I didn't do Edinburgh. Nah.
Okay.
Nah.
Because I met a few Aussie, because there was a few guys who had come over to Edinburgh in like the sort of mid-90s.
Yeah, I was around then, but I didn't go. Yeah,
and yeah, there was because what had happened was, is obviously pre-internet and all that. There was like when I got here, there was a few guys who had seen me in Edinburgh, because I came over here 99 was the first time I came. I was aware that there was a group of Australian comics who had been in Edinburgh who had gone.
Like Judith and the Empty Pockets and those guys, Fleety, all those guys.
Yeah. Your Tonys, Tony Martin had been over.
Tony, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And they'd sort of gone, they'd gone, oh, you should see this guy. So there was people kind of coming along. So, and also weirdly, there was, I remember when I first moved to London, I moved to London in 95, and then Limo was...
yeah, starting comedy.
He
yeah.
was starting.
Matthew Hardy. Mate, mate, how's it going, mate? How's it going, mate? Mate, mate, you're doing well.
Yeah, yeah, mate. Matthew Hardy loves to fuck.
Remember he used to come on and shoot a gun in his act to, when Prince... Remember Prince Charles had someone run at him in Australia with a gun and shoot him?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it was a starting pistol, I think. And then I remember seeing Hardy in London. I came over there in 95 and did a few gigs, and he would run on stage in London with a starter pistol and shoot it and go, I'm fucking Australian. Where's the Queen?
Well, because did you...
Way to start a gig. That's great.
And back in those days when you could just carry guns around.
Yeah.
I mean, Owen O'Neill used to do a thing.
I remember him, yeah.
Yeah, ginger guy. Irish fella. And it was when the police were... Do you remember the police were like shoot... They were... Oh, those were the days when they just used to shoot the Irish.
You know,
there was a lot of... There was a lot of Irish people were getting arrested wrongfully, you know, IRA connections and stuff, and people getting shot because they thought that they had weapons and stuff. And Owen O'Neill used to do a gag where he'd go, knock, knock, and the audience would go, who's there? And he'd pull out a gun and he'd go, bang, 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 the police. And...
Good joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Good solid joke.
And he told a story about how he got drunk and fell asleep on a night bus and ended up at Heathrow Airport with a gun late at night. And then the cops took him in and went, oh my God, you've got this gun. And he went, No, it's not. I'm not, it's for a joke. And then and they went, what's the joke? And he went, oh shit. It's great. But Matthew Hardy used to, so there was a guy, did you ever come across Jim Tavery?
Yes, he played the bass.
Yeah,
he toured a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had his own show, his own sketch show.
Yeah, that's right. Which, funny enough, I used to do the warm-up on. I was warm-up.
And Hardy wrote for it, didn't he?
And also one of the, that was... which never gets talked about. It's sort of been erased from history, but that was Ricky Gervais's first ever...
he appeared in it.
His first ever TV thing. He used to do a couple of sketches because him and Steve Merchant used to write these sketches, and then he was... And that was... I think that might have even before they were on the radio, maybe, but...
Yeah, wow.
And there was a lot of stuff in that show which wouldn't have been repeated now. he used to have a sketch which was, which funny enough was predated Little Britain. He used to have one, the unconvincing transvestite, where it was basically him dressed as a woman just starting fights. And you go,
yeah, right.
Like, you know, the Little Britain's, you know, like, you know, I'm a lady and all that.
I'm a lady. Like, I love lady things. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a much more full on version of that. So, yeah, that show will never be seen again. But
never be repeated again.
Well, it was on Channel 5 as well, which that was like they launched a new channel in the 90s, and then. They didn't have any money, so they would do a comedy show and go, right, we need 100 sketches, but you've got to do them all for, you know, just fill in time, you know.
Now I asked people these three questions on this podcast,
right,
Ross. What was the last thing you cooked?
Ooh,
are you a cook at your house or?
No, I, well, there's been
quite a few other comics that don't cook. Some do, but some don't.
No, what happened, right, was I always, as you know, I never bothered with the cooking because I just eat out all the time. And
the road.
Yeah. So then when, yeah, so then when my wife and I got together, I would sort of like, we just have completely different, we just like different food. So we never eat the same food because neither of us likes the stuff that the other one's into. We don't like the same things. And then the kids aren't fans of the stuff that we like. So, and there's
three lots of meals going on then.
Yeah. And then, Young Frankenstein, they came back over. We decided to move back to Australia. So they came back over, and I was like 2 months, 2 months on my own in London, where I was just, I just rented a flat right next door to the theatre. And, I did a you know that show, that River Cottage show, Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall.
Yeah, of course.
Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall was doing a show. He was doing this TV show about like encouraging healthy eating and stuff.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
right.
So he basically said, "Do you want to be on the show? And I'll teach you how to cook." So I went, "Yeah, I'll have some of that." So He released this book, and it was all about like weirdly, I look at it now, and it's his way of cleverly sort of introducing like vegan cooking and stuff, like and I was the perfect candidate, because I'd say to him, because here's the thing, right? Left to my own devices, I would just eat chicken. That's all I would eat.
I just like barbecue chicken, sort of thing.
Like a chicken,
or fried chicken,
like chicken. No, not fried chicken. No, like chicken wings. You know, just like baked, baked oven chicken wings. And in fact, so much so that when I was doing the producers, Jason Manford, who was also in it, we were in Dublin, and there's a load of restaurants. Somebody in Dublin decided they would make themselves the number one chicken wings place. So then another one opened, and then another one, and now there's now 10 places in Dublin that all claim to be the home of the chicken wing. So
in Dublin,
yeah. And so we were there for like a week. We had 8 shows to do in a week, and then. You don't really get not that much time, you know. So we decided that for a whole week we would eat nothing but chicken wings.
Oh,
and we would go. No, I love chicken wings, and it was not a problem for me. So we'd have lunch at one chicken wing place, then go to the next one, have a bit of chicken wings, and then get to the theatre to do the show, and then obviously
and afterwards,
and then on a Wednesday and a Saturday, you got 2 shows, so you got to try and get to the one closest. And we did that for a week, and I ate nothing but chicken wings. And on the flight home, I went, "Well, that's weird. I think I've broken my foot, and I got gout."
Oh, wow. You got gout.
And I don't drink, so it's not like I could go.
Yeah, it's not from the drinking.
So I got this.
It's a chicken wing.
Horrific gout from just having no fruit or vegetables at all.
Did this guy teach you how to cook healthy?
Yeah, yeah.
River Cottage man.
Yeah. So I said to him, I said, I want to be able to cook food. I want to be able to cook vegetables that are as tasty as chicken wings. And he went, yep, no problem at all. And then, so he did. He showed me how to like roast up vegetables and like kind of crisp things up, so you get that kind
they're not soggy.
Same sort of texture. And I went on this thing where because I was in the flat by myself, I was going to this market where they sold like all fresh vegetables and stuff. So I'd go down there, and I'd come back, and I'd make myself a bit of he gave me this recipe book. So I went, so I worked my way through. And there was one day where I made this soup. I made this this beetroot based soup. And I was looking at my watch, and I'd left because it took me so long. I was looking at going, "Oh shit, we've got to go," you know, because you've got to go and do like a for the dancing, you've got to do a dance warm up. So like, so before every show, you've got to get to the, you know, the show starts at like 7:30. You've got to be there at 6 o'clock because you've got to do vocal warm up, dance warm up, any notes and anything that needs working on the show. So I was looking like, oh shit, and the venue was only 2 minutes from my flat. And I went, oh shit, I'm gonna be late for the warm up. So I just got the soup in the pan, still steaming, and I just walked to the theatre with the soup. And I thought, so I was walking through the West End of London with a boiling hot pan of steaming soup. And I get to the theatre, there was some people outside that were coming to the show. Can you sign this for us? Hang on, just hold my pan. So they're just holding the pan of boiling soup. And I went in, put it in my dressing room, put it down on the counter, and then went and did the dance warm-up, and I had a lovely, lovely soup afterwards.
Soup,
But the thing with that was is that I got back to Australia, and I didn't tell my wife. I was like, right, I'm going to surprise her with this now that I am a vegetable cook, right? So I came back, and I went, right, sit yourself down. I'm going to cook for you a vegetable vegan extravaganza. And then so I cooked her a few things, and thinking, well, that's it now. I've ticked all the boxes. I've improved myself as a human being. And here's the two things that went wrong there. One, she was furious about the amount of time and dishes, like the amount of mess that was made from cooking. She said like the kitchen was covered in stuff, and it was too messy. Too messy, took too long, and also it wasn't really to her liking. The food was it wasn't to her palate. The 2 months that I spent like really, I made this one thing. It was like a cashew, like it had like it was like a leek. It was like a leaking cashew bake, you know, like a crispy bake. I loved it. It was really nice. And she just went, that's horrible.
Didn't like it.
I tried to feed it to the kids and they didn't like it. So at that point, I just went, you know what? Sometimes it's good to try and improve yourself, but you know what? If that's your attitude.
So I'll stick to chicken wings.
So to answer your question, the last thing I cooked was, it was chicken wings. Last night I had chicken wings last night, but I have also got into which is sort of, you know, those there's a company down here that does Be Fit Foods, you know, it's basically just like frozen foods, but it's all fresh and that, and so healthy. I've taken to that just because it's it's like a microwave. You know, you get those microwave dinners. I used to have those. Yeah. I do them, but because they're like healthy foods, I get to pretend that it's... I sort of get to pretend, well, you know, this is really good nutritional food, but ultimately it's because you can just bang in the microwave, you know?
Yeah, it's like a TV dinner.
Yeah.
All right, so what... I just love your chicken wings. You're still... How many chicken wings do you eat when you eat chicken wings? Like 4 or 5 or 6 or?
Oh, I mean, that's more. It really depends on.
Yeah.
It depends on what trousers I'm in at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
You know. It's, the way I look at it is, I used to eat like a whole roast chicken. I could easily knock off a whole roast chicken. So I look at it and go, well, if it's 10 wings, that's not, you know.
It's not a chicken, a whole chicken. No.
Yeah.
What was the last thing you watched or listened to? That's one of my other questions.
Last thing I watched or listened to was, I listened to a bit of Pod Save America, the podcast.
Oh, yeah, right.
I listened to that this morning. And then last night I listened to... I watched the final episode of Devs.
Oh, what?
Devs, do you know it?
Devs, no. What's
that? It's Alex Garland, who he wrote a lot of the stuff that Danny Boyle directed.
Yeah, he wrote The Beach, didn't he? Yeah.
And he did that. He wrote that film Ex Machina.
Have you seen that? Yeah.
So,
in the future.
And then so he's written this one with Nick Offerman, who plays this tech. He's a tech guy, and he has this kind of big tech company out in the woods, you know, like a kind of a Google type thing. Oh. And they've got a development department, devs, and
I get it. You see what I mean? That sounds great.
It's you know what, it's really good. It's a little bit because he directed it as well. There's times where you know he's enjoying himself. He's enjoying himself with the visuals and that, and it's a bit it's a little bit arty, but it's worth sticking with for that. And I'll tell you what else I watched, which I thought was absolutely phenomenal, right? I watched day before yesterday, I watched Invisible Man with have you seen that one, the new one?
Directed by Lee Whannell.
Yes.
The Aussie.
Yeah. And
I've seen the trailer, and I used to know Lee. He used to do a movie segment on Triple R when I did Breakfast there. Oh, he would come in and review the movies.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. I mean,
he would tell us he wanted to be a Hollywood director. We're like, yeah, whatever, mate. What movie did you go and see this week?
And then he wrote Saw, and I'm guessing after he got the money from Saw, he probably went, well, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing the movie reviews
of Triple R.
That's
good to hear. It's good. Yeah.
Oh, great. No, it's because it's one of those things where, like, it's Blumhouse, and you sort of look at it and go, but no, they've taken the whole Invisible Man thing, and you know, it's interesting. They've made it less about you know, cops flying around, and they've made it more about kind of
intimidation and stuff, isn't it? He harasses his ex-wife or something.
Gaslighting, sort of emotional, abusive relationships is what they've made it about. And I thought it took me by surprise, you know, because I wasn't. And I tell you the other thing I watched as well, which is on. It was on SBS, but it's on. It is on YouTube now. A thing called this is probably old news now, but it's a couple of years old, but I watched a little web series called Wizards of Oz, like AUS. Have you seen that?
Oh, no, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's really good. It's about a wizard, like a Gandalf type character, who is living in the the magical realm, and he gets fed up of it. Decides to have a normal life where he's not going to use magic anymore, and he moves to Melbourne. And he's basically just and it's like, there's this really funny episode where there's a mate of his that he knows who's a shark that works in an office, and he goes, and the shark's just trying to fit in. And all his co-workers are just basically being racist to him because he's a shark. And then the wizard's trying to he wants to get a wheelie bin because he thinks that'll be normal. And there's this other bad wizard that's just going, just magic one up, and he's like, no, I want to fill out the forms and I want to get the wheelie bin. And then that's
watch this.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, alley. Yeah, it's called Wizards of Oz, AUS, and it's
great.
If you try on SBS, it's not available anymore, but it is on.
It's on YouTube.
On all YouTube, right. So yeah.
Cool. So, my last question is: what's the last bit of human contact you've had because of COVID? Most people say their partner, but some people say the person in the shop or something, you know.
You know what, it was my daughter. She hasn't got the COVID, she's just got the she's got the snot on her, so it's a bit sad. This 7-year-old child that's been sort of, we can't take her out in case people think she's got the COVID.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it's
yeah,
kind
yeah.
of But yeah, the yeah, it would be my wife, but I'm getting really, because as soon as it happened, all the gigs went, and there was no reason for me to leave the house. So
yes,
so my wife was doing the shopping, and I basically just so I just went, you know what, this is I'm gonna see this as a treat. I'm gonna see it as a, you know, because the idea of me not having to leave the house, not having to travel,
it's unusual, isn't it? Yeah,
so unusual. So I just went, you know what, she said, look, I'll do the shopping. And because we were like pretty full on, we were like kind of she'd come back from the shops, and we'd sort of disinfect all the shopping, change the shoes, and we were really strict about it all. So I didn't leave the house for like 2 months.
Wow.
Which, I mean, we live on a farm, so I don't need to. Like, I can go off and I can go. I still ride my motorbike and my push bike, mountain bike, whatever. So I just didn't go out, and I loved it. It was just, it was absolute bliss. Like, I, you know, it sounds really bad, but everyone was talking about how much they were losing their minds, and I was the complete opposite, you know. It was,
well, it's like a holiday for you, you know what I mean? It was
the thing that made me really want to do it was just before they brought the lockdown in. I was down the shops, and the woman was there, and it was, you know, you remember that time, everyone's getting a bit nervous, and it was all a bit, you know, it was all a bit like the world's going to end, and what's happening, and what we're doing. And the woman went in the shop, she just said, so you won't be doing any comedy gigs then? I said, no, I'm not. I said, I've lost all my work. It's all gone. And I thought you'd go, oh, that's terrible, because, you know, comedy's still a job in the way that you feed your family, and there'd be some,
exactly.
She said, oh God, we all need a laugh now. Have you got any jokes for me? and when she said that, I went, I'm not gonna leave the house unless I have to. And then that was the last thing that anybody said to me before the lockdown. And then they brought the lockdown in, and then every day I was just looking at it, just going, and at the point where I think, oh, I should take the kids out, and, like, you know, we should go, you know, go down the beach, or do, like, you know, go and have
do something.
Yeah, I'll go to the dinosaur park. In my head, I'm just going, I don't have to. And I just had that woman in my head just going, got any jokes?
Tell some jokes.
Just going, you know what? I'm just going to stay. I'm going to stay here and not move. Yeah. And it was, and to be honest, it's been absolute. And I'm not one of those, I'm not complaining, because it's one of those things where, like I'm the sort of person who, you know, if I'm down the shops and somebody comes up and wants to chat to me, I'll start, you know, and it drives my wife mad sometimes.
Yeah.
I'll talk to them, happily stand and talk to them, you know, and whatever. It's not a thing. But when all of a sudden it was like, oh, I don't have that obligation to connect with the world. You sort of, like, quite sort of selfishly, I just went, oh, even things like, this makes me sound like such a curmudgeon, but, like, even things like, you know, like if you're on tour and you do like a 100-date tour, that's, you know, that's probably 70, 80 hotels that you're checking into.
It's a lot. Yeah,
and
it's a lot.
And that's not, you know, and that sounds like, I'm not whinging, because I understand, well, especially not now as I don't have any work at all. But, like, yes, you know.
We're all unemployed now, but yeah.
Yeah, there's that weird thing of just, you know, you just that thing of, like, walking up to the desk and just going, and having to go, you know, and the person going, checking in, and you go, I'm not here for a chat, you know. It's like
yes, checking in today, sir.
I'm checking in.
I also love that, how's your day been? They don't really care about,
oh,
your
no
day.
But
I don't care.
I sometimes do that, where they go, how's your day been? I go, pretty shit, to be honest. And they go, oh
yeah.
And they don't know how to react. They're like, oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Have you been to Adelaide before? Yeah, I don't really like it. What?
Have you been
before? Yeah, I've been. I don't mind Adelaide. Adelaide's fine by me.
But the fact that you just go, have you been to Adelaide before? You just go, no. What wonders? What wonders are there to behold? Tell me. I have travelled from afar, and here. But how? Sorry, I've just been waffling on.
That's what this podcast is
talking about myself. So, So what's your feeling on the? Because I haven't actually talked to anyone about the sort of. Obviously, I've talked to my wife, where she's going. This is all fun and games, but in about 6 months' time, the money's gone.
The money's gonna run out.
What is your general? I'm very good at going. Nah, it'll be fine. This shit will work out. Where are you at with the whole?
I reckon gigs will start up again in maybe September,
right?
October, November.
But what do you think?
But they could be like those bad corporate gigs or something. When you go to a function, they go, we didn't get a big turnout, so we've spaced everyone out. You know those gigs where you go, oh, no. So I reckon venues will be like that for the first few months, which is not ideal to have.
Right.
And for someone like you who does theatres and stuff, it's just not going to be viable. You know, I'm thinking more the smaller gigs will come back.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
We had... the gigs that we had to cancel on the tour, they said, you know, when they went, it's capped at 500, and then, you know, no more than 500 in the room, and you know, it's playing like Newcastle, the Civic in Newcastle, and there's like, you know, you got three times that, and you go, so what have we got to do three nights now instead of the
exactly. I was wondering that.
But do you think it's because they said it was going to be like you're allowed 50 people, and then then they've reduced that again. But
in Victoria to 20, but it'll go back to 100 eventually. Yeah.
But is that going to be like, is it the sort of thing where, because again, it's one of those things where, you know, you can make 100, you know, 100 people, you know, if you take a 500 seat theatre and spread them out, you can put 100 in. That would work.
Yeah.
But then the problem, I reckon, is that, say you've got people who regularly play, you know, like at the festival or whatever, they can sell out 100-seater room at the comedy festival.
Yeah. But
all the venues which are, say if you can fill a 1,000-seater room, but you're only allowed 100 people in that 1,000-seater room, all of a sudden, and this is purely selfish, all the people who were playing 100-seater rooms now need
a 1,000-seater.
The 1,000-seater. So basically what's going to happen is
that's not going to work. The economics of it aren't good. You won't make money renting out a 1,000-seater and getting 100 people. We all know what that's like. The theatre hands you a bill at the end of the night and goes, you owe us. this much money. So I don't know. It's I don't know. But they reckon in England the stand-ups aren't going to come back this year at all. You probably know better than me. That's one of the comics said over there.
I've got so I moved my tour. We had whatever it was. It was like a 3-month tour, and we rescheduled all of that to January, February of next year.
Yeah.
Thinking, because we were trying to go, we could probably do towards the end of this year, but obviously because everyone's trying to reschedule the
And
it's not just comedy as well, you know, it's like kind of like
bands
and Andrew Lloyd Webber and all of these, like, you know, you look at all of these venues and stuff. So we changed it all to January, February. They've made such a balls up of it in the UK that I just can't see them getting. So I think I might have to reschedule the rescheduled gigs. That might have to be pushed back That might have to be pushed back another 6 months or a year. But like I say, you know, I've pretty much, I think I've got about 6 months before it's before it becomes, the British, the culture secretary or whatever, he's going, well, you know, we want to, we want to support people in the creative arts, and you know, certain people have, they've been doing. We're looking at supporting like online shows and stuff. And as soon as he said that, I went, oh, you know nothing. You just don't understand. What you've described there, mate, is television, haven't you?
Yeah. That's TV, yeah.
That's what you've. So, yeah, who knows? I mean, I'm very, I'm always optimistic. I'm always very, I always sort of look at it and just go, every down is an opportunity. I see it, you know, every sort of, bump in the road is basically, it's just an opportunity. And I have to be honest, at the moment, I'm starting to, I'm starting to feel a bit, the doors that should be opening because of the, one door closes, another one opens.
Yeah.
It at the moment, I'm starting to feel a bit like it's not gonna be great, you know. So I don't know. We'll see
what happens.
Yeah.
Now, Ross, you've got to go. I've got to go. We should actually plug your podcast too, which I listened to, the where you basically, you're obsessed by film clips, and you and Ed Cavalli, music clips.
Yes.
And it's a very funny episode where you go through Cliff Richard's Wired for Sound.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Which we learn a lot about Milton Keys, where it was filmed. Because I, of course, remember that film clip. Yeah, he was quite a good roller skater, Cliff Richard. But it is a great that is a terrible song. I always hated that song. But yeah. We all remember the film clip, and it is a great. Your podcast is fantastic.
Oh, so thanks! Well, thanks for that. It's
and have a listen to it, everyone.
It's just called Ross Noble Podcast, and yeah, I mean,
very easy to find. Easy to find.
Yeah, yep. There's a with all of the because basically, like in our house, we've just got music. It's basically the news channel or pop videos. We just flick between the two, there's a lot of podcasts out there where, you know, they're about reviewing, you know, movies and television and stuff, which, you know, if you haven't seen the thing, it's quite a lot of commitment to, you know, it's like I started listening to a podcast that was like a spin-off like show discussing The Handmaid's Tale.
Oh yes, I know the one. But I haven't listened to it. Yeah, yeah.
Eyes on Gilead, I think it was called. And yes, and it was one of those things where like, so I only started watching The Handmaid's Tale when I think there was already two seasons were out.
It's good. It's great. The Handmaid's Tale.
It's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah,
and. Look at me, but I've plugged two Elizabeth Moss projects.
Yeah, you have.
You might also like to read the books of L. Ron Hubbard.
Yes. So she's a Scientologist, that's right. Yeah.
Yes, but it was one of those things where like I was looking at it going, I'd like to do a podcast, but I'd like to do one where you basically only, the thing that you're talking about, you only need to spend 4 minutes of your life looking at it before the thing. So yeah, we've done what have we done? We've done The Weeknd, we've done Wired for Sound, and then we just did what's the one that we just did? Oh, we've just done which will be out this week is have you seen the video? Halsey, You Should Be Sad. Have you seen that one? It's where she's basically wearing leather pants and dancing. She goes to an illegal, like a sort of underground line dancing.
Familiar.
She's sort of she's dancing around, surrounded by hay. So we talk about that. And we basically watch it, and then we decide at the end, like, we talk about what's the story, what are the health and safety implications of of what happens, and then how badly the video will affect the local moth population. So that's the show. So
that's it. Have a listen, everyone. Hey, Ross, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
No problem at all. It's my pleasure.
And we'll speak to you again soon. Ross Noble, ladies and gentlemen.